Good evening and welcome once again to a Fireside Chat. This is your host, Lance White, otherwise known as the Zany Mystic. Tonight my guest is Joel Rothschild, author of Signals. Joel's book has earned high praise from such notables as Elizabeth Taylor, James Van Praagh, Deepak Chopra, Neil Donald Walsh, and many others, myself included. It's my pleasure to welcome Joel to the show tonight. Hello, Joel. How are you?
I'm doing really good.
Oh, good. Good. Wonderful. Since you're an old hand at interviews, I'm going to kind of let you start talking about the book and you know, take it wherever you need, would like to go with it.
Okay.
What inspired you to write your book?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. The book really wrote it itself.
Uh-huh.
I guess we should tell people listening what it's about.
Yes.
And it not only wrote itself, it found its own place on the planet and it affected people in ways that I could never have predicted or ever imagined. People who don't know this particular book and don't know the story, the short end of it is that, you know, in the briefest summation, I am one of the longest living AIDS survivors on the planet, full-blown AIDS since 1986.
Wow.
Back in the 90s, in the late 80s, when there was no cure for AIDS, all of my friends had AIDS. And my closest friend and I made a pact that whoever died first would contact the other one from beyond. I don't think I put this in the book. I was a card-carrying member of the National Atheist Association, which was Madeline Murray O'Hara's group.
Oh, no, I didn't read that.
Yeah, I thought about it afterwards. I should have probably put it in to at least illuminate how much of a skeptic I was. And he took his life. Another thing you don't know this either because you read that book and you probably didn't read my other book.
No.
Hope, is I didn't say why he committed suicide. And what just sort of fast forward, without giving away any of the punchline, I was at the time in 1994, I was on chemotherapy for Kaposi sarcoma, which you know what it is, and
yeah.
I had dropped down to 110 pounds.
My God.
And I didn't put the contents of his suicide note in the book because I wasn't prepared to share it with the world at the time that I penned the book.
Uh-huh.
But he committed suicide because he thought that I was going to go and he didn't want to live without me and he wanted to be the first to go.
Wow.
And so I had to live with a lot of guilt and a lot of emotions attached to that.
Uh-huh.
But we had this pact that whoever died first would try to contact the other one from beyond. And the book, immediately, I found his dead body, and immediately on finding his dead body, things started happening. And I kept a journal of those things,
mm-hmm.
and that became the book.
Wow.
And I really thought that 10 gay men would read that book. I didn't think that, you know, anyone would ever read it. And now it's in 20 languages, and amazingly enough that the readership is almost 98%, 99% female.
Wow.
Which is an interesting phenomenon.
Wow.
From Catholic missionary nuns to young girls to 90-year-old women. I don't know why, but there seems to be a deeper, more profound spiritual sense in women, or it gravitates to women. I don't know what that's about, but it certainly has a stronger effect on women.
Well, but it's a book from the heart, and it moves the heart, and men are a little bit, we're a little bit more removed from emotional issues, I think.
Maybe, yeah. The book did its own thing. You know, I always say, people say to me, you know, how do you get a book published? How do you get people to read your book? How do you, you know, that book hit number one at Amazon.com. It was
on
the London Times bestseller list. How do you get people to read your book? And I'm just not coming from a place of ego.
Yeah.
It did its own thing.
Yeah.
You know, that book was the only book that Paulo Coelho, who wrote The Alchemist, ever endorsed.
Uh-huh.
And his endorsement brought it to international publishers. And the way that it found its into Paulo Coelho's hands was I sent it to a woman in Brazil, a friend of mine's mother, who had breast cancer in manuscript form. and thinking it might give her some comfort and some peace, which it seems to do for people. And she was in an elevator finishing the last page crying, and Paulo Coelho walked on the elevator and said, "What are you reading?" And she told him, and he said, "I'm on my way to Israel. I'm getting on a plane. Let me take it." And he endorsed the book.
Wow.
So it's one of those things where life has a way of doing what it's supposed to do, I guess. And I think that the real greater picture is that Albert was such an advanced, enlightened soul that he had his hand in it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think he wants, it's really honest, straightforward. I don't even think my name should be on the jacket. I didn't write it. He wrote it. I was just the messenger.
The thing that really makes this quite unusual for me is when I started reading about how he was communicating with you afterwards, and then you began actually seeing spirits around other people that wanted to talk to those people. Do you want to talk about that a little
bit? Well, it was a little, you know, it was a little different than, you know, the traditional James von Prague or John Edwards type of sensation. And it was a shorter period of my life, but there were those times that I outlined in the book where I was with someone and I got a very clear message for that person. It was different than the typical psychic thing in that so many psychics begin with questions. Those were just quick statements, and they were right on target. I was very, at that point in time, very highly tuned into the other side. And I don't know what more I can say about that other than it was really amazing.
Was there a time when, like myself, when you didn't believe in life after death?
Oh, I think that I've almost all of my life up until that morning, which was June 1st, 1994, had always been, you know, I was raised Jewish. I was bar mitzvahed. Because I was raised Jewish and had read so much about the Holocaust, I had lost faith in God.
Yeah.
I didn't think that there was anything after this. I thought if there was, it was just too unfair.
Yeah.
And that life was so unfair and unjust that I was pretty hard and bitter and caustic.
Now, you were quite ill then during the early years. Were you taking AZT?
I actually was one of the first people on AZT. I was on a phase two AZT study at USC with Sandra Levine. And that was a toxic drug, but in some ways may have helped me stay alive.
I remember when I first took it, that was about 1987 or 88.
Mine was 86.
Yeah, I think we're both very long-term survivors. I've been at it for 23 years, and you're probably longer than me.
Well, I've full-blown since April 22nd, 1986. I know that I'm full-blown since 86. I don't know exactly how long I've had the virus. Yeah, we're dinosaurs.
Yeah. I don't know about you, but I never thought I'd be alive at this age.
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, I was sitting on my balcony the other day, and I saw a guy walk by that I haven't seen in 10 or 15 years. And last time I saw him, he was 25, and now he's probably 40 or pushing 40. And I thought, God, he got old fast. And then I thought to myself, no, you're just not used to seeing people age.
You
don't know what the process looks like.
So,
yeah, no. And now my godmother's 98 years old in the nursing home. I'm spending a lot of time there because I feel like I won't have that time again. And it's amazing how people in that process go through the same things we went through. But
well, you know, you had KS, which my best friend Don died of those complications, and I remember going through all these experimental changes and
alpha interferon, interleukin.
Yep, they flew him back east and they injected these oil things into his body.
And the young people today don't remember. I'm writing they don't remember that time frame. And in my other book, Hope, there's a couple chapters that are dedicated to that period of time, which I really feel like they captured it in a very strong way. I'm writing a screenplay now, and It's I'm trying to, because it's a timepiece, and I'm trying to remember that, mm-hmm. and memorialize it so that people realize what we went through. I mean, I don't like to go backwards, but we missed a lot of opportunity. I mean, at the time I was diagnosed with full-blown AIDS, there were like 18,000 cases globally. Now we have 43 million, and we had Ronald Reagan, who didn't say anything for almost four years.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, those things haven't changed much, have they?
Well, you know, some things haven't changed, but in some ways things, I mean, tremendously changed. I told you the other day, you know, about this new integrase inhibitor from Merck that I'm on, and uh-huh. it's an amazing medical breakthrough. So, I mean, we do have, you know, people giving money and time, and I've met churches embracing people with AIDS. I mean, it's certainly much different than it was when, you know, a senator would say behind closed doors, well, yeah, you know, they want money for their perverted disease, tell them to stop having gay sex, or that it was a good thing. You know, there was that whole spirit in the country that it was a good thing because it was only killing gays and drug addicts.
Yeah. Well, I think that was what it was intended to do.
Well, that was a lot of people embraced that.
Yeah.
So, but Signals, the book, is, you know, it's really not a gay man's story. It's not a story about AIDS. I thought it was.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it was about me losing someone I love. It's a funny thing when you write something and you put something into paper and it becomes a book, and then it totally takes on its own life.
Yeah.
You know, it really. A friend of mine's pregnant right now, and I looked at her husband and I said, I'm kind of glad that I'm a man that I never had to go through what she's going through, because she's at the last month of pregnancy and it's really uncomfortable and horrible. And she looked back at me and she goes, I don't think it's so great. I wouldn't want to be a man. She goes, because you'll never know what it's like to give birth.
Mm.
And I thought, you know, that's an interesting point. I never thought about that.
Mm.
And writing a book, not that in any way it can compare to bringing life onto the planet, but it is like you have the baby, you write the book, and then it goes off on its own and does its thing. I mean, I could never have ever imagined that you would have called me, that literally thousands and thousands of women would write me letters.
Yeah.
And that survivors of suicide groups embrace the book.
Yeah.
Because there's all these other, you know, it becomes what it is for each person who reads it. For example, survivors of suicide embrace the book because Albert committed suicide and I wasn't judgmental about the suicide.
Yeah.
And that was just a natural thing for me because there was no reason to be judgmental.
Yeah.
And it seems to be very forgiving to those readers about suicide when so many other books, even Sylvia Brown's books, are condemning suicide. So it has its own little healing ability and warmth for different people.
Oh, yeah. Was there a time when you actually contemplated taking the same route after him? Or
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were a couple times in my life where I thought about committing suicide. And, you know, we got the suicide drugs together. My whole group of friends went down to Mexico and got them. We read that book. It was pre-Final Exit. We read the book, Let Me Die Before I Wake. Same author.
I remember that. Wow.
Yeah. And, I mean, it was very common at that time because we had decided that, you know, if we didn't want to deal with blindness. One friend didn't want to deal with dementia.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I definitely thought about it. I definitely was almost there twice in my life, and so I've said to a friend just the other night, she said, I was telling her what it was like in the nursing home, and she goes, God, if I ever get like that, I'll kill myself. I said, you know, Patrice, you won't.
No.
Because it really takes, it's sort of a different animal, different type person that can kill themselves.
Yeah. What were some of the, once you discovered that Albert was still communicating with you, did that kind of help you keep going, and did you?
Oh, there's a sense of peace and calm in knowing that you have a guardian angel or a spirit around you.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how many signals that we all share. I mean, people, you know, the book came out in 99, so we're now 7 years, almost 7 years later. I've received, you know, tens of thousands of letters from people describing their own signals from loved ones, and it's amazing how many of them are similar and fall into patterns. And it's interesting how a man, and again, I'm getting back to the male-female thing. I don't know why, but I don't know how much time we have, and I want to...
We've got about 45 minutes.
Okay, I'm going to tell you my best signal story, and there's a punchline to this.
Oh, good, good.
And there's a real good punchline to this.
All right.
And it has to do not only with the differences in men and women and where your heart space is at, but anyway, out of the 30,000 letters, I started keeping them. I thought, someday I'm going to get to writing a book about other people's signals.
Mm.
And I had a neighbor that his mother had been killed by a drunk driver. Father had lung cancer, and his wife had breast cancer. Wife dies, and I give him the book. And he has a six-year-old daughter at the time. He reads the book. He says to me, very well written, engaging. I don't believe any of it. And I was emotionally detached from people's reactions before the book even became published.
Yeah.
And so that was it. A couple months later, his father dies. I get a call at 3 o'clock in the afternoon from Cedars here in Los Angeles, and he says to me, my father just died. How do I tell Debbie, which is the daughter who's now six, at that time like 6.5 years old. And don't forget, this little girl has already had, she's lost everyone practically. Okay? And her whole family unit was dwindled down to her father, right? And so I said, look, I'm not a grief counselor. I'm not a psychologist. I don't know. I don't think you should tell her. That was my sort of a knee-jerk reaction. Don't tell her.
Yeah.
It felt wrong to me. And I thought he should see a professional. And one of my close friends is a psychotherapist. And I thought she could find a child psychologist, and that would be the way to go.
Yeah.
And he says, I got to tell her. And he hangs up the phone on me. So I get home, and... later that night, and I get a call about 9 o'clock at night. He says, this is really weird. Debbie came home from daycare, and she was smiling and beaming, and she came running up to me, and she said, Daddy, at nap time, Grandpa came to visit me, and he told me to be a really good girl because he was going to be with Mommy and the angels, and I wasn't going to see him for a while.
Oh, my God.
And wait. It was the best signal story I ever heard.
Wow.
I have this whole category in my collection of signal stories about from the mouths of children.
Oh, my.
And it rose to, you know, my top five at least.
Duh.
And you know what the punchline was?
What?
He says to me, I still need to tell her, right? That didn't mean anything, did it? And years later, I reminded him of the story, and he still didn't think that it was a signal. It obviously wasn't for the little girl. I mean, it was obviously a signal for him.
Yeah.
And, you know, it has to, where the diametrically opposed position is, I had a woman whose husband was the conductor from the Milwaukee Symphony, and he had MS. And she had written me a letter. They read the book. This happened a lot, too. People that were terminally ill and they had a loved one terminally ill, they'd read the book together and they'd make a pact. And she wrote me a letter and she said, I haven't gotten a signal, I haven't gotten a sign. You promised me by writing this book that I'd get a signal. And I always write back and say something like, you know, you will in time, and maybe ask for signals. And just after this was the day after he died, you know, the funeral was a couple days later. And on her way back to the limousine, a chocolate bar wrapper got stuck to her shoe, and it was a Hershey's Symphony chocolate bar wrapper, just a little piece of paper.
Yeah.
That was more of a signal to her than this neighbor who had this amazing gift from his daughter.
Wow.
So it has to do with where people's heart spaces are at, they're ready. It's an interesting phenomenon. People go through, you know, we're all so different, but we're all made up of so much of the same stuff. And when people lose a loved one, they're torn apart, and they have these emotions that happen for everyone. I mean, pain and agony and wanting to pick up the phone and call them. And I'm not sure if during that time for most people signals can come through.
Mm-hmm.
I think it takes a bit of calming and healing, and I think that you and listening to the other side, you know, mm-hmm. and that's why so many people say, well, I dreamt of him and I had this lucid, vivid dream and he said this in the dream and I'll be okay. And people, we still stand back and we say, oh, well, that really wasn't a signal. It wasn't a communication. And it really was.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
So, it's definitely an individual thing,
mm.
you know, signs and knowing that someone's with you. The good thing about the book is that it's opened people's hearts up to having hope that there is something beyond.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of neat to have, to know that you were able to participate. For me, it's neat to know that I was able to participate in that process. And I really believe, this is going to sound really stupid at this time of war, I really believe that one person, any one person, can impact the planet. And I think that just the littlest random acts of kindness matter on a big scale.
Mm-hmm.
So
I agree with you on that one.
And so I'm grateful to have participated in this process. You might want to know that I donated all of the proceeds from the sales of the book to an AIDS clinic for the poor here in Los Angeles, the Jeffrey
wow.
Goodman Clinic.
Wow, that's so awesome.
You know, and wow. that's why I don't do it. It says at the end of the book that I don't take money for speaking engagements or anything.
Oh, my.
Just because I felt like I didn't need to profit on this or want to profit on this.
And, yeah, yeah.
And I didn't want my credibility on this challenge either.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a hard thing to come out and say, well, you've had signals from beyond, and to share those.
Yeah, it's becoming a little bit more. People are coming out of the closet a little bit about that subject, though. And don't you feel that people like James Von Prague and the other one that you mentioned earlier that tells people, you know, oh, yeah, your mother's sitting right next to you and she's telling you this and that and the other thing. James Edwards.
John Edwards.
John Edwards, yeah. Don't you feel like they're kind of opening that door a little bit more?
I think they've opened the door in a huge way for a lot of people. And at the same time, I think they may have closed the door because I think that a lot of people see them as charlatans.
I think
that there's a big... I think that there's a bit of a negative reaction and skepticism to that as well.
Huh.
I've seen both reactions to them, and that was one of the things that I really was careful to do in this. I made a statement at the end of the book that I don't take any money for any of this.
Uh-huh.
I would never take any money for any of this, and I've never charged to consult or meet with anyone. And I really wanted to draw that line there.
Yeah, yeah.
And not that there's anything wrong with, if someone has a psychic gift, being able to share that and earn a living, because everybody has to earn a living. I just was fortunate in my life that I didn't have to, having had my own business.
Mm-hmm.
I think it helped at least some of the readers.
Yeah. Oh, it's a wonderful book. I mean, it's so beautifully written. I mean, it really feels like an inspired piece of writing. I mean, it's
funny that you say that. You know, most of that book, I would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I would just pen a chapter. Literally, I never took typing in high school, so I never learned how to type. So I just did it longhand.
Uh-huh.
And those were the chapters that the publisher said you don't need to change anything.
Wow.
And it was really like I was in a deep, almost, you know, really late at night. That was when most of that book was written between 2 a.m., 2:30, and, say, 4:30 in the morning.
Now, those are quiet hours. And
yeah, and waking up from a sleep. And yeah. I think that that's probably the time we're most connected with spirit.
Uh-huh. One thing that... I have noticed being somewhat of an activist during my lifetime is, I mean, you really have been. I mean, you're walking the walk and talking the talk. So, but I've always felt that that the gay scene is shifting and moving around, and it's been kind of, well, it has been kind of nebulous of late, and I keep praying that there will be more acceptance of people, but no sooner do I think that that will happen than I hear somebody on the Christian right condemning, you know, the whole subject. And do you see any changes in that area in terms of
I think that with the fall of the Berlin Wall, mm-hmm. we became the Christian right's scapegoat. Mm-hmm. And I noticed a real shift as communism sort of was, you know, for a while the great evil. And and I think that the moral majority of the Christian right really needs enemies, and I they need to put people in categories, and I think it ebbs and it flows. John Ricci, the writer, said it best. He said, "We're the only minority that's born into enemy camp," and it's kind of a strong thing, but what he was saying is that it was incumbent on every generation to educate the next generation, because mm-hmm. when you're, you know, African American, you're still, for the most part, for most families, you're African American with your family, or you're, you know, Jewish with your family, mm-hmm. and when you're a little gay kid, you're kind of alone.
Yes, oh yeah, absolutely.
I shouldn't say little kid, most people figure it out when they're in their teens, but when you're in your teenager, you're a teenager alone. And so I think, activism and changing attitudes, I don't know. You know, some ways I think we've come a long way. Will and Grace is on TV, but then again, it's on TV with this effeminate buffoon of a character.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
People still have those stereotypes.
Yeah.
You know.
I don't know. I have a friend who's a painter, David Hockney. You probably know him.
Oh, yeah.
And David said, I asked him, when are we all going to get together as a minority gay people and move forward? And he says, well, getting all gay people to agree on anything is like saying you're going to get all women to agree on anything, you know,
yeah.
or all men to agree on one point. You know, you
yeah.
can't, there's so much diversity in the
yeah.
community
yeah.
that, you know, I mean, there's gay Republicans and gay Democrats and gay pro-war and gay anti-war and
yeah.
gay right to life and gay not right to, you know.
And it's amazing how judgmental we can be of our peers as well. You know, and also, I don't know, I'm going to bring this up because I think it's something that we need to be aware of. I know that there's a speed or meth epidemic going on, too. Which
absolutely, right now, out of control here.
Yeah.
I don't know about in your city, in Los Angeles, unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny because my physician volunteers at a treatment center. She's a MD and PhD in molecular biology, and she still volunteers, but she says it's so biologically addictive.
Oh, yeah.
That the
yeah.
success rate in treatment is like 5%. It's really small.
Yeah.
And I've seen so many lives destroyed by it. I mean, it's just unbelievable, and it's, you know, it crosses color barriers and
yep.
Economic barriers, and it's a very insidious drug. I remember when, you know, in the 60s when I was a kid, heroin was the big deal,
mm-hmm.
and this is so much worse.
Yep, yep.
So I when you start thinking about the world and you start thinking about war and you start thinking about Sharia law in the Middle East and you start thinking about, you know, disease, and I mean I don't want to sound like I'm some sort of old hippie, but I really feel like we have to embrace what's good around us,
yeah.
focus on what's good, and impact changes where we can.
Yeah.
You know, Cindy Sheehan, I love what she does.
Yeah.
I mean, she's an example of how one mother stood up. And whatever it is, I mean, even if it's just, you know, at Christmas, I go and I volunteer at a homeless shelter. I mean, it's just, if there's such a great joy in giving back,
uh-huh.
and you can affect one person's life just every day. You can go through the day and focus on making one person happy. It's a neat trick being a human being. There's a lot of really wonderful things about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of wonderful things that we can do, and people seem to be caught up in worrying and, you know, stressing about money and You know what it is? That's the thing that maybe, having survived all of the people I ever loved closely, dying and AIDS and everything, one of the things that I learned was that you don't have to feel good or you don't have to be financially comfortable to be happy.
Right.
Happiness is a sense of being that comes from within and transcends all of that. And I think the quickest way to get there is by being of service. I mean, I'm not a 12-step person. I'm sober. I've always been sober. But I think even in the 12-step program, they say that being of service is what matters.
Yes, yes. Yep, I agree with you on that one, too. I think that it's very difficult for us who are, you know, buried in materialism to turn away from selfish things or things that serve us to benefiting other people, because we're just not used to thinking that way. We're kind of hypnotized by television and
the movies. I don't watch TV anymore, and I don't watch...
I don't either.
I don't go to the movies either.
Yeah, me neither.
I don't see... Even though I'm writing one right now, I don't go to... I'd rather read.
Yeah, and me too.
It's just so frustrating. But the other thing is, I wanted to add, in terms of being of service, you can also be of service to an animal. You know, I mean, I have the max amount of dogs that they let me have in my building.
Oh, aren't they wonderful?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, just rescuing a dog. I mean, just it's interesting. I had to inspect. I was helping someone who was a construction defect attorney friend, and I had to inspect go with him on inspections of these apartments. And I went into so many people's apartments, and they were brand new plasma, whatever they're called, LCD or whatever the expensive new thin TVs are, and there were video games. You know, I really saw a shortage of plants.
Yeah.
And maybe an L.A. thing. There weren't any pets. There weren't a lot of plants. There weren't a lot of books. And I thought, is this where we're going? I don't know.
Yeah.
It made me question. Could have just been this area. I don't know. I do know that people seem to be reading less and...
And thinking less.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's funny. I play a little game with a friend of mine. You know, we'll think of something that stood out in our memory, and we'll ask someone if they've ever heard of it. Chappaquiddix, for example, or who Goring was, or who Himmler was, or, you know, just something. And it's amazing within our immediate history. I mean, in the past 50 years or 100 years, people have already forgotten, let alone... I mean, there's always that thing. They have that thing Johnny Carson used to do where they interview people on the street and they, you know, they don't know who's buried in Grant's tomb, and they're not kidding.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have hope, because there is a lot of really kind people. I mean, every time I read something about Bill Gates, you know, here's somebody who's got billions of dollars really doing something good for the planet. Or Oprah just gave $40 million to a school in Africa, my father told me today. And so I don't know if we saw, you know, very wealthy people 100 years ago caring about the poor. So, I mean, I think there's a shift. I hope there's a shift for the better.
I do too. It might get worse before it gets better, but... it seems like some of those that are at the very top of the pyramid are kind of still hoarding quite a bit.
Well, I don't know. I'm not there, so I don't know. But I think that that's kind of sad, because then you have to live in your body. You have to live in that spirit of being in a place where you're not. You're denied by hoarding the joy of sharing, the joy of being good, the joy of doing good for other people. I mean, the reward, that catchphrase, the gift is in giving, it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think the best thing that we can do, I mean, I don't know if you remember how Signals, my book, started out. I remember I had this little brief comment about generalizations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's the first step in healing for all of us, is to not generalize, you know, gay, straight, men, women, this. And I did the same thing in this conversation. I said, well, most of the readers were women. It's true. So there must be some truth that we're different, and we're different, but not to focus on our differences, but to focus on our similarities.
Mm-hmm.
on our humanness.
And spirit is spirit. You know, doesn't it seem that spirit is something that transcends our bodies and our feelings and our thoughts, and it's something that's more uniting rather than dividing?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The scariest thing for me, and I don't focus on this, I really try not to focus on it, is that right now there's so many people that are with these acts of terrorism. You know, it was like the kamikaze pilots in World War II. They're willing to take their own lives and kill innocent people for something that they really believe in, or a religion that they really believe in, that seems to not respect this amazing, precious gift of life. I mean, it's these nursing home visits every Sunday have really taught me, more so than ever, and more than I learned with AIDS, how really short and fleeting this is. You sit around the table with octogenarians and 90-year-old people, and you hear the same things. I hear the same things every weekend. Never thought it would happen this fast. Mm. Never saw it coming. Didn't think I'd get here. Gosh, it went so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start, and you realize that in our lifetimes, how much faster time seems to be going now than when we were 15 years old, and that 15, how much faster it seems to be going than when you were 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
This is such a short little journey.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a shame to waste any of it.
Yes. Yeah, very good point. Very good point. And plus, you know, I personally wouldn't want to be on my deathbed and look back and regret everything I've done.
Oh, God, I can't imagine anything worse.
Yeah, or conversely, regret the things I hadn't done.
You don't want to regret anything. And the other thing, the one thing that got me through Albert's suicide, aside from the signals that are in the book and the whole experience that happened after he died, was that when he died, and I found his corpse, and that's a really horrible thing. Not too many people have to go through that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's why I really do relate to people that have lost a loved one to suicide. It's unbelievably painful. But the one thing that was comforting in that moment was that when he was alive, I told him I loved him every day.
Yeah.
And I was able to do it literally every day of our lives.
Yeah.
And he said it back. And there's really something to be said about, remember that song, In the Living Years, Say It Loud?
Vaguely.
Yeah. You want to be able to share your love in the living years. That's why you have to get to a place of forgiveness and letting go and not holding on to the crap.
Yeah.
And the anger and the frustration. It'll fester inside your body, and it'll cause cancer, and it'll rot. I think I said in Signals that definition of forgiveness that I learned, that it's not something that you do for someone else. You do it for yourself, because all of that negative stuff, you have really two choices. You release it to your own benefit, or you keep it inside and it causes cancer.
Right.
I mean,
right. Take your pick.
Yeah. I mean, it's really that simple.
Yeah, it is.
If you hang on to that stuff, you end up bitter and mean and horrific and in bad shape. And if you let go of it, you're not only helping yourself, but you also are helping the universe too.
Oh, yeah. And then you've also set a model for other people that you can do it, that it can be done.
And that's a really important thing. It's a really important thing. That's the lesson in this book for me, is that while I can impact a positive change on a bigger level than I ever thought imaginable, anybody can do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anybody and everyone can impact positive changes in our communities, and that grows and spreads on the planet.
Did you have any moments towards the end of writing the book where you were just kind of halted, or were you able to just complete it naturally?
Well, early in the a little while ago, I said I was detached emotionally from the outcome.
Uh-huh.
After I had finished the manuscript, I was still attached to, you know, people's reactions and the outcome. And I volunteered at a hospice here in L.A., and I gave the book to the head nurse in manuscript form, and she had no reaction for weeks. And I'm volunteering one day, and a woman comes running up to me, and her brother had been in the nursing home for about a year, and he really should have died, you know, in his first month. It was a lingering, horrible death. Mm. She was in tears, and she said, "I read your book to my brother, and he died last night, and it helped him cross."
Wow.
And it was really a sort of an instantaneous change in me. What happened is I realized that was enough good to have come out of the manuscript that I didn't need anymore to happen.
Yeah.
And so I sort of detached. So that was a big change for me at the end of writing the book, you know, and towards the end. And it wasn't even through the editing process. I realized that, okay, I helped one person by putting this to pen. That's enough.
Yeah. And you just kind of let it go and turned it over to the universe. Too.
Absolutely. It just did its own thing. It's so neat how it just went and just, it's that we're talking here 7 years later about,
yeah.
You know. I mean, it's so fascinating. A woman wrote me an email last week and she said, "I was Albert's best friend in elementary school.
Oh, my God.
Can I call you?" And I mean, things like there was a period of time, I don't know if you remember, I talked about in the book where we lost touch.
Uh-huh.
And he was actually at the Fashion Institute in L.A., and his roommate got the book. You know, here we are 15 years later, and called me and said, "Would you like photographs from that time frame?"
Oh, my.
So, just... Well, amazing stuff.
It's like you send a ripple out and you have no idea how it's going to be coming back to you.
Yeah.
You mentioned Andy Warhol in part of the book. Was that a part of your Wilder times?
I don't remember mentioning Andy in the book.
Well, no, maybe I... Maybe
but it's my friend Robert Cohen, who's my best friend, first friend to die of AIDS. We were bar mitzvahed together. I don't know if I talked about the book. It's been so long since I've read it. But he became the head bartender at Studio 54 and was friends with Andy Warhol. And then my friend out here, John Gould, was boyfriends with him for a while.
Uh-huh.
And I met him a couple times. I don't think I really talked about that in the book. Oh, I think you're thinking about I did a dedication to my friend Keith Haring.
Yeah, I think that was it.
Yeah, maybe that was it. Because in the dedication to Keith was really about, he was such a great person, and I was kind of hoping the world would remember him less for his paintings and more for the kindness that he did.
Uh-huh.
The same with Elizabeth Taylor. There was yes, she's had an Academy Award, and yes, she's had this illustrious career, and she's a legend, but I hope people, when they think back on her lifetime, remember how many different organizations she helped and how much kindness and how she caused the global shift by herself.
Oh, yes, yes.
I mean, you know, this was before, you know, this was totally not self-serving. So that was part of the reason why the dedication was written that way.
Yeah, she's an amazing lady.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, it doesn't take fame and fortune to be amazing. And you know, you're probably a living example of that, although now you're famous. And
no, I'm
I
not.
Don't know
no,
if you're
I'm not. I'm not in any way, shape,
and it's
or
okay
form.
To have money. There's nothing wrong with that. But
I'm not famous, you know, and I'm comfortable in life. Economically, I'm not, you know, I don't drive a new car and I don't, you know, buy fancy clothes and, you know, I don't need the same things that seem to make a lot of people happy.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody's different in their definition of what being comfortable is.
Yeah, yes, definitely. Do you still have experiences with people coming through from the other side, or is that kind of tapered off?
It's really tapered off.
Okay.
I would say about once a year.
Huh.
Something very strong will happen. You're talking about where it's a signal for someone else.
Yes, yes.
About once a year. And I have very, very, about once a month, a very, very lucid dream of a conversation with Albert. That is definitely an interaction with spirit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely tapered off. But, you know, it's funny, I carry it around with me all the time now, so people have said, well, do you think it's tapered off because his soul has evolved and moved on, or another reason? And I think it's tapered off because I'm in a place where I'm at peace and I feel that he's with me, and I don't know. I don't know why it's tapered off.
Huh. well, whatever you're doing it right.
Thank you. I'm doing the best I can. I don't know if there's a right. I'm just doing the best, you know, trying to be the best I can, and that's all I can hope to be.
Mm-hmm. Are you working on a book now? I think I saw mention of that somewhere, that there was another book in the works.
Well, I have, you know, this book that I started, Other People's Signals. I start collecting people's signal stories, and I put it down for a little while because I had this idea for a movie, and I thought that what caused the shift is that I did actually get a letter from a Catholic missionary nun, and the letter started out saying that she literally used the word, "I've despised gays my whole life."
Wow.
And then and she was in Africa treating people with AIDS, and she goes, "Someone, I don't even know how she got the book, but she read the book and she understood that love is love." And that was just before 9/11, and then I started getting letters from firefighters, like the 1% of the men that read it always started the letter. My wife maybe read this book, and was firefighters, and they said, you know, "I used to use the word faggot, I'd never say it again." I realized I had made a shift in people's consciousness with the book, or participated in a shift. I can't really say that I took credit for it, but I helped impact a change in people that I think is a positive change.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, as I was starting to write Other People's Signals, well, you know, gosh, movies are such a powerful vehicles. That and a friend asked me to be in her movie. She's doing sort of a version of What the Believe type.
Oh, wow.
A movie along those lines. It's about healing. And I realized that, well, you can make a big shift in a bigger shift perhaps in film. So I've been writing a screenplay now. So that's where my writing time is going.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's really exciting.
Well, we'll see. Yeah, I mean,
I'm still working on my first book, and I'm stuck on the last two chapters, so I haven't given birth yet.
Well, Edward R. Murrow, you must know who he was.
Yeah.
He said to Ernest Hemingway on an interview, "How were you so prolific?" And Hemingway was amazingly prolific. And you probably heard of the Lost Hemingway Trunk, where he lost all his early body. His wife lost all his early body of work. You know, on this steamer trunk to Europe.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, Hemingway says, "It's really easy, Mr. Murrow. There's a product that you can buy." And he says, "Oh, what's the product?" He says, "Well, you just get it at Sears and Roebuck." He says, "What's the product?" He says, "Butt glue." And he says, "What?" He says, "You glue your butt to a chair and you just do it."
Oh.
So writing is, you know, the thing about the screenplay is I set certain hours a week, mm-hmm. and I sit down and I just do it. Because if mm-hmm. you don't, then it won't get done.
It doesn't get done, yes.
Yeah. And so I think that Signals was inspired, and it's so fun to write and cathartic and healing. The screenplay is more something I sit and I force myself to write.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, and writing is a process of rewriting and rewriting and rewriting. At least it is with the screenplay.
Well, that sounds very exciting. You know, you mentioned the Catholic nun that had so much hatred for gays. Where does this hatred come from? Do you know?
In her case, she said she was raised in a very conservative family in Poland, and I think that we fear. Well, I mean, isn't all hatred based in fear?
Yeah, I think so.
And I think that we fear the unknown and what we're not, you know, accustomed to or comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably where a lot of it comes from.
Mm.
I don't know why. Generalizations. You know, I started the book out talking about generalizations.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of fear, a lot of hatred comes from generalizations. Very, very risky to start putting people into groups.
Yeah, yeah.
Not a good thing.
Well, we're already as divided as we can be. I think we need to go in the other direction.
Here we are.
You know, what was it? Rodney Collins said, "Can't we all just get along?"
Yeah, Rodney King.
Rodney King, yeah.
Yeah. And here we are. You are. And, I mean, that's part of the human experience. Maybe it's because we're all in these separate containers, you know, these bodies, these vehicles that make us different. I don't know. I don't know why that is. I will tell you that I'm sure you probably already know this, but when I connected with Albert after he died, the coolest thing, I mean, the most embracing, wonderful physical sensation of connecting with him was that those barriers were gone. From the place where he was at, that all spirit becomes one, and that we are all interconnected, and it's this shedding of our bodies. It's just this amazing experience.
Wow.
I have really strong opinions, and I don't like to be opinionated, but about where we go after this and what happens, and I really believe that we're going to this place of communion with all spirits, and past and present, and it's a beautiful place of peace and connectedness, and that the aggravation and all the negative things that we talked about are really on this planet. And I'm not, and somehow they serve a greater good. Somehow it's a, you know, a cleansing of the universe, and somehow it serves a purpose that we can't see or understand from here. Mm-hmm. But we're going to this place of joy.
Mm-hmm. There's quite a few people who subscribe to the idea that the Mayan calendar, which ends in December of 2012, is going to be a major date when humanity is going to shift into a higher level of consciousness, too. You know, and there are all kinds of ideas that Earth is evolving and she's raising in her dimensions. And, you know, so there could be all kinds of exciting things going on. There's no way to prove any of these things, but, you know, yeah, if you can have experiences with spirit, I think almost anything is possible.
I agree. I think, and I don't know where we're going, and I don't, you know, and this planet, my opinions are where we're going after we leave this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I come back to the basics in terms of while we're on this planet, we need to do whatever we can to make the ride or the journey better for those of us, you know, that are suffering or that are, and everybody suffers, and in not as good of a place. And that's the cool thing about the book, is that Signals really affected people in a positive way.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
How'd you find it?
That's
a good question for you.
Oh, you're going to turn the tables on me now, are you?
How did you find the book? I'm curious.
That's a darn good question.
It's always fascinating to me how people come to, you know, which books they find and how they find a book.
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know. I was doing some kind of search on the internet, and I ran across it and thought it sounded really interesting. And because it was similar to my story, too, and I hadn't finished my story, so I thought, well, maybe I should check it out. And then when I started reading it, I couldn't put it down. I mean, it just drew me in like, you know, I felt like I knew you. You know, and I that's part of your letting it go, I think, that, you know, it got written and everybody has their own relationship to it and their own experience to it, but it really does transcend everything. It's a wonderful book.
Yeah, it's neat that it transcended the gay experience.
Yes, yes.
You know, I love that, and that's not important to, you know, some readers, but it's something that's really cool for me. That it's not a gay book. That's so cool. That I was so wrong, you know, when I thought about who would read it. I thought, and it's funny because when the book came out, there was like a lot of media attention, and I was getting these, you know, great TV shows, like Lisa Gibbons was on the air at that time, and Roseanne, and I was getting like, I can't even remember. There were so many magazine articles, and I couldn't get The Advocate. It was funny that I didn't get any of the gay publications printing anything about the book.
Really? That's funny.
It was kind of neat, yeah.
I like that, you know? I really like that. That appeals to me quite a bit because, again, it's about transcending things that really aren't important. You know, it's a matter of spirit. And I did kind of wonder, because although you don't get explicit in some of this, you know, it definitely talks about male-to-male relationships and lovers and this and that. And of course, that's all, you know, old hat to me, but I thought, gee, some of the straight readers who read this, but apparently most of the people who read it are straight.
I'm not exaggerating. In the high 90s,
wow.
Probably 98%.
Wow. Well, that's
are heterosexual.
Do you have any really inspirational stories that you want to share? Anyone that stands out in your mind that...
In terms of a reader's response?
Yeah, or, you know, anything that's happened to you or anything.
Gosh, I don't... I mean, if there was something that you asked me that I wanted to share to a bigger audience, it would be that, you know, in the time frame that I lived with full-blown AIDS, 23 million people have died.
Wow.
And that part people say, well, how did you survive? And yes, perhaps it's been medicine and good care. But I think that no disease in the history of mankind is 100% fatal. And that if I could survive this, then anyone that hears my voice can survive any kind of loss.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the difference in surviving loss or even thriving in the face of challenges, physically, emotionally, spiritually, financially, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
is the ability to just focus on the positive, to let go, and do all the things that we've been talking about,
mm-hmm.
And to keep, you know, to keep hope alive. And I'll tell you what we were talking about earlier, my own times when I felt like I was suicidal. You know what? One of the things that got me through those periods of time was the friends around me that held hope for me when I was pretty fragile.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an obligation to help each other, because there are times. I mean, that's my biggest problem with the way our country is set up,
mm-hmm.
is that we don't accept the fact that there are certain people that can't help themselves, and we don't take care of them, the homeless. And I think that we have an obligation to take care of the people that can't take care of themselves as a society and as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
We have an obligation. It's not, you know, this contract that costs us a lot of money. We have an obligation to hold hope and to help those people around us. It's not something that you do out of obligation. It's something that brings back more love.
Yes, yes.
I mean, I think if we were a culture of a society of taking care of people and helping people, you know, we would be a country that was out there showing the rest of the world how it should be done, or
yeah.
how it could be done.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a beautiful thing to share with us. Would you tell people how they can get in touch with your website and find out more about the book and read about you?
I don't, you know, it's funny. I don't know where they're still selling the book. I think they still pretty much have it at most bookstores.
I got it at Amazon.com.
It's interesting because Amazon's a funny thing because, you know, it says so much for resale books that
yeah.
new books don't get sold a lot there. So Amazon's a funny thing, funny phenomenon. But it's pretty much everywhere, and it's the website, which probably needs to be updated, is just my name. It's just Joel, and it's Rothschild, Rothschild.com. And the book Signals, I mean, basically, I think if they put the word Signals in, they get it anywhere on the Internet.
Well, I highly recommend that, you know, anybody and everybody read it, because there's something in there that will move any spirit. You know, there's no question about that. And I really applaud you for just for what you're doing. It's just you're really a model for all of us.
That's
and,
really
you know,
kind.
You're making me feel guilty that I'm not doing enough.
No, you know, it's so not about that. It's so
I know, I know.
It's so about, like, taking a moment and just petting your dog, or being in line at the grocery store and focusing on somebody's beauty.
Yes.
Saying,
yes.
you know.
And about being happy, too.
Yeah, focusing on someone's smile and just
yeah.
little shifts. It doesn't,
yeah.
you know. Everybody, I can't do what Bill Gates is doing, and somebody listening to this can't maybe write a screenplay, but that doesn't mean that we can't do what we, our little, like I said, the little acts of kindness that really... William Wordsworth, a good man's remembered by his little nameless acts, random acts of kindness and love. Something.
Oh,
like
yeah.
That.
Oh. Well, Joel, I think we're just about at the end of our time.
I really appreciate that you took the time to write me. Call me anytime. And I'm here. We'll talk again.
Oh, good.
And I really appreciate that you gave me a little space on your show. It's very kind of you. And together we'll help one person who's maybe thinking about suicide.
Yes, yes. And everybody does make a difference.
And the show makes a difference. See? There you have it. You are making a difference.
Wonderful.
In a big way.
Thank you so much, Joel. I really appreciate having you on here. You're wonderful.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And for folks listening still, be sure to stay tuned for Liz Millar. Her Otherwhere show is fabulous. It's even better than mine, if you can believe that. So this is Zany Mystic signing out. That was another Fireside Chat. I love you all.